From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks your business is really, really all right, like peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Morgan Spurlock. In his new movie, he trains his lens on Comic-Con and comes away with a sweet portrait of some committed fans. But first, the Hollywood News banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, we talked a little last week about the, I have to say, truly crazed Hollywood auction for this book that has been described in the New York Times as mommy porn, 50 Shades of Grey, about young Anastasia Steele and her older billionaire lover. That auction was resolved with Universal Pictures and its Focus Film label being the victor. $5 million for the rights to something that started out on a Twilight fan site and has now morphed into a certified phenomenon.
And it's not just the money that was eye-popping. It was the creative controls that the author and her team were asking for, which involved, according to somebody I know who was bidding on the project, approval not only of the director and the cast and the writer, but, you know, department heads.
Wardrobe, John. She wanted control of wardrobe and lesser cast members.
I thought there was no wardrobe. I thought they took their clothes off. How about control of leather props? In any case, it was one of those things where you saw a true frenzy and you saw people who you would never kind of associate with mommy porn like Brian Grazer bidding on this property. It really did attract everybody. I think not so much because they thought it was the next 9.5 weeks, but they thought it was maybe a Twilight for older women, a female empowerment story. I don't know. I'm sure Focus, you know, played its lust caution card very cleverly. We've made, you know, a hard sex film. We've done Brokeback Mountain. We can deal with the subject material. I guess if you spend that kind of money, you got to make the movie. So the next step is who is going to play the young girl and who is going to play the older, richer man.
And, you know, the thing that's striking to me, it's not clear what Universal ceded in terms of actual control. But with somebody who would propose this, you know, they can't afford to antagonize an author. You can't have Hunger Games come out and have the author say, I hate this movie. So even if they didn't give it to her on paper, this author, E.L. James is her pseudonym. She's a former British television executive. I have a feeling she's going to be quite a handful for the people who are making this film. And I think certain people in Hollywood who desperately tried to get the project probably woke up in the morning the next day and said, what just happened? What was I doing? What was I thinking?
Yeah, and if the movie goes on to gross $12 million, they'll be happy they didn't get it. If it goes on to gross $100, they'll be saying, why didn't we?
Exactly. It's the Hollywood way. Nobody knows anything. Now, the cast of Modern Family seems to know what they want. They are kicking off what is sure to be a pretty tough negotiation with 20th Television, which produces the series. That's a Fox subsidiary. And they are asking for some pretty amazing pay raises. And just to be clear, I'm talking about the key adults, not including Ed O'Neill, who plays the fortunate husband of Sofia Vergara, but all the grown-ups.
Yeah, and it's not quite Friends territory, where at the very end of that show, the leads were making $1 million, but they're looking to more than triple their average salaries from $65,000 a week to about $200,000 a week.
Now, this show is a gigantic hit. It is, most importantly, number one with younger viewers, which advertisers covet. And it's been very important for ABC. And let it be said that ABC and 20th Television, they will make lots and lots and lots of money. And, you know, I covered the Friends thing back in the day, and people said they're so greedy. But the fact of the matter is, when you have a hit like this, you do want to ask yourself, who do you think should get the money? The people who perform, you know, are they out of line, or is it just reasonable? And should the studio keep all the money?
Well, I mean, it bears mentioning that ABC made more than $160 million on advertising from Modern Family last year. So when you have $160 million plus in advertising revenue and an actor's asking for another $120,000 a week, It doesn't seem like it's that far out of line, given how popular the show is.
And that's not even counting the revenue from repeats and syndication, which is going to be mind-bending. So, yes, there is a lot of money on the table. I'm wondering about the kids. Are the kids going to get together? Is Manny going to team up with the other kids and say, we deserve a raise? Or is Manny kind of special and get a little more than that? But I'm sure their agents are thinking it over probably right about now, because this is when a show has been on for this period of time is when you start looking for the big raise. Meanwhile, another Fox-related entity, namely News Corp, the parent of Fox, is looking at starting a new sports network, which is a very competitive area right now with obviously ESPN and NBC looking and Comcast looking to make big noise and compete with ESPN. This would be yet another attempt to get into that space in a bigger way.
Yeah, Fox right now runs regional sports networks. I watch all my hockey on Fox Sports West, and they have Fox soccer channels. They have these little kind of toes in the water. But it's not just competitive. It's wildly profitable. I mean, ABC is making a fortune for its parent company. And if you start looking at the numbers, the average cable subscriber pays $5 a month for ESPN. So when you start adding other competition, if Fox comes along, if NBC kept spending on its sports programming, it's going to drive the fees that these companies are paying for football, for hockey, for baseball. And where do you think those fees are going to go? They're going to go under your cable bill. So while it might be good for News Corp, it's not going to be good for a consumer, because it inevitably means that you're going to pay a lot more to watch sports, even if you don't watch sports.
And that would be me. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can keep up with us on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. Coming up, Morgan Spurlock and The Con. Morgan Spurlock made his name with his 2004 movie, Super Size Me, in which he ate only McDonald's food for 30 days straight. He survived that and became a prolific producer of documentaries and nonfiction television shows. In his latest movie, Spurlock turns his camera on Comic-Con, the annual comic book convention in San Diego that has morphed into a celebration of fantasy and fandom. Comic-Con draws 150,000 visitors, and many of them are members of a geek brother and sisterhood. For them, Comic-Con is like a homecoming.
You know, you can come to a place where nobody's judging you or making fun of you because you're a 6'2 black man who likes to wear a superhero costume.
I've always described it as kind of a big family reunion whenever I come back.
It's like having a country of your own.
Whenever I go inside, I feel like I've gone home.
And all my years of coming to Comic-Con, the thing that draws me back to Comic-Con every time are the people. Well, that's what I look forward to. That's what Comic-Con is to me, and that's what it's always going to be to me.
These fans walk around in costume, shop for that special edition to their action figure collections, and attend presentations by their spiritual leaders, including director Kevin Smith and Joss Whedon, creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Spurlock directed the film, and this time he isn't on camera. I asked him if he'd been a visitor to Comic-Con over the years before he decided to make this movie.
I went to Comic-Con the year before this. We shot this film in Comic-Con 2010, and I was at Comic-Con 2009, and I'd never been before that. I got a call from Fox to do the Simpsons 20th anniversary special for them, and so the minute we got that phone call, I was like, we're going to Comic-Con. We're going there. We're going to find Simpsons superfans. We're gonna have this American Idol-esque casting. I have an excuse now. I have a reason to be there. Someone else is going to pay for it, which makes it even better. And so we went there to find Simpsons superfans, and in the middle of us shooting this special for Fox, I said, this place is a movie. Like, this is a movie in itself. Like, the people are amazing. The stories are great. And later on that night, I met Stan Lee, the legend that is, you know, the creator of Spider-Man and Thor and X-Men. And I went to him and I said, Mr. Lee, I just want to introduce myself. You know, as a kid, you changed my life. You know, as a child, grew up in West Virginia, I read your comics and, you know, your stories were one of the things that gave me the courage to want to tell my own stories that inspired me and motivated me. And he's like, oh, my God, Morgan, thank you. That's so nice of you. I would love to make a movie with you. We should make a movie. We should do a documentary together. We should do a documentary about Comic-Con. And I was like, that's a great idea, Mr. Lee. Thank you so much. And then, like, cut to a year later, there we were making a movie at Comic-Con, produced by Stan Lee, produced by Joss Whedon. I was like, how many people does Stan say that to? He must say that to everyone, but I was the one who actually believed it. You know? And so we were making the film. Like, we went to Stan and Joss and all these guys and said, here's what we want to make the film about. Here's the people that we're thinking of following. And, you know, they would give their input and guidance when needed and necessary. And it was great. I doubt Comic-Con would have given us the green light had they not been involved. Yeah. That's right. Because otherwise, it's like, oh, that guy. Here comes Spurlock wanting to make a movie about Comic-Con. What's he going to expose down here?
Right.
And I think that the fact that I went with Stan, with Joss, kind of gave it, you know, this level of credibility and made them confident that I wasn't going to come down there and kind of throw him under the bus.
I have to say, in my unbaked, uninformed way, when I started to watch the film, I was like, where's Morgan Spurlock? He's going to take me on a tour of Comic-Con and he's going to make jokes about Comic-Con.
Yeah.
And you were not there.
Not in one. I was Stormtrooper number 7, passerby number 7. Yeah. It's like, yeah.
I mean, why did you come to it that way?
Well, when I got the idea for the film, you know, and it was myself and my producing partner, Jeremy Chilnick, we started talking about making this movie after that chance meeting with Stan Lee. And, you know, I said, this film is about fans. Comic-Con exists because of fans. These genre movies are popular because of fans. Video games survive because of these fans. They should be kind of the heart and soul of the movie. And I'm a fan. I've been a fan my whole life. But me as a fan going to Comic-Con to make a movie about Comic-Con isn't the story you should tell. You should tell the story of the people who are going there for very specific reasons, whatever goals they have, whatever is driving them. That's what you want to have the story be.
So you were a little lad in West Virginia loving the comics?
Reading, you know, Stan Lee comic books as well as, you know, I loved Plastic Man. Like, Plastic Man was actually the comic that I grew up, that I loved the most as a kid. To this day, I still don't know why, but I loved Plastic Man. And I loved genre movies. Like, I loved horror films as a kid. When Michael Ironside made that guy's head explode in the movie Scanners, directed by David Cronenberg, it changed my life forever. Like, that guy's head exploded, and I was like, that's it. I know what I want to do for the rest of my life.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Morgan Spurlock about his new documentary exploring the world of Comic-Con. Financing for the film was arranged by Thomas Tall of Legendary Pictures, which produced the Dark Knight movies and Inception.
We've been meeting with all these investors, and I was on a plane flying to Los Angeles. And as I'm on the plane, you know, whenever I get on a plane, I usually buy like 6 or 7 magazines, you know, from the newsstands. The one time I go and clean up on magazines, and I get on the plane, I read through them, flip through them, and I got a Wired magazine. And in this magazine, there was one of those full page profiles of a person, you know, where the person stands full, you know, the whole page long, but it kind of tells who they are and their accomplishments, their heroic statements. And here's the story of Thomas Tull, the creator of Legendary Pictures, the movies that he's made, why he loves these movies, being a fanboy himself. And as soon as the plane landed, I got off and I called Micah Green at CAA and I said, I want to meet Thomas Tull. And I said, I want to meet Thomas Tull about Comic-Con. And he's like, that's a great idea. And I met Thomas that day. And before I met Thomas, like, I'd met with a bunch of other investors and said, here's the movie we want to make. Here's what it is. And they're like, great, we'd love to make that film so long as you're in it. And I was like, that's not the movie I want to make. I don't want to be in this film. This film isn't about me. And they're like, well, then we're not going to finance it. And I'd say, great, we'll find somebody else. And we probably met with 4 or 5 other distributors before I sat down with Thomas. And I said, here's the movie we want to make. And he goes, I love it. He goes, I will definitely help you put together financing for this. And you know, and I said, I'm not going to be in the film. He goes, like, no, I get that. I love the idea. I think it's great.
But he doesn't say, I will write the check. He says, I will help you find the money.
Yeah, but if somebody like Tom Stoll says, I'm going to help you finance this movie, then you're pretty good to know it's going to happen.
Budget.
We went in with a budget of about $1.5 million to Comic-Con.
I mean, he could do that.
I think it's in his couch.
Might
be rolling around in his back seat. I don't know.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, so how is there a process at that point where it's like, now Thomas is going through the 12-month seeking of financing?
No, it's fast. I mean, you know, somebody like that gets involved in a film and says, you know, here's what it is. You know, we're going to put together money, you know, and I'm going to be the lead investor and producer on the film. And they're like, great, I'm right behind you.
So at this point, you did have Joss interested.
At that point, Stan and Joss were already attached to the film. Thomas came on board. We also, at that point, we also brought in Harry Knowles, which you know, was brilliant. I mean, Harry, who's lived and breathed in this world as well for years and years and years. His father, who owned one of the first comic book stores in Texas, his father started the Texas Comic-Con that actually happened in you know, outside of Austin. And Harry, who was really instrumental in us getting Chuck Rosansky, you know, the comic book dealer that's in the film.
Right.
Because as we started putting together, like, who are the archetypes? Who are the people that we want to follow in this movie? And he's like, oh, my gosh, if you want a comic book vendor, you have to call Chuck. Chuck is the guy. He is the guy.
Where is he based? He's based somewhere else.
In Colorado, Denver,
yes.
Colorado.
And he has this enormous...
like 60,000 square feet filled with millions of comic books. Like
right.
Millions and millions.
And hair down to his butt.
Hair down, like Willie Nelson, ponytail down to his backside, and is just kind of the renegade of the comic business.
I make the claim that we're America's largest comic dealer simply on the basis that we have 8 million comics and we service more customers than anyone else. I've gone to Comic-Con 38 straight years, and I am one of the last survivors.
He's one of the stories that you follow through the film, and I always wonder this about documentaries.
Yeah.
You know, you're bringing in, you have a guy who's like the military guy from, I can't remember the state.
But Minot, North Dakota.
Minot, North Dakota.
Yeah.
And then you have this other guy who is a bartender from...
Columbia, Missouri.
Columbia. I mean, where are you finding these people?
Yeah.
Because you're, just to be clear, you're following them as they prepare to go to Comic-Con.
Correct.
They're not, you didn't just randomly walk up to them at Comic-Con.
No, the key characters that we followed, we put out this massive kind of casting call through comic book shops, through con websites, through Ain't It Cool News, you know, with Harry and his support of the film. So we got, then we got inundated with a deluge of submissions for people wanting to be in the film, probably about 2,000 people, you know, sent us letters, sent us videos. And then from there, we just started to whittle it down.
I am the biggest comic book Comic-Con freak ever.
I'm the guy. That's right. I'm the guy. I've got the biggest collection. I'm going there to, you know, to pitch my comic book. You got to follow me. And there were people that we were like, this guy's great to interview for the film, but not to be one of our lead characters. And we whittled it down. The very first character we said yes to follow in the film was Holly Conrad.
She's the costume person.
Yeah, she's the costume person. Lived in San Bernardino. Now she lives in Los Angeles, but was living there with her mom at the time. And she makes costumes out of her garage.
There's Mentone over there, which is like the meth capital of the world. And easily, I'm sure my neighbors think that I'm making meth. They're like, that girl, she's a druggie. I saw her outside looking really tired and wearing weird clothes. I think she's a meth addict. But actually, it's just because I make costumes in my garage, so...
Less to be clear to our listeners, these are not just something your kid wears to the Halloween or school play.
This they're like animatronic sculptures, like these giant, like for people who play the video game Mass Effect 3, like she made a Krogan for this. She made a costume where she was Commander Shepard.
An animatronic Krogan. I never thought I'd say that off the air, on the air, anywhere in the world, but I just did.
First time ever on KCRW. Right. Thanks for listening. Listener supported, please send checks immediately.
Really, because that cost me some effort.
That's right. But it's amazing. And we got her tape. And I watched it, and people can still see it on YouTube. Like, if you do a search for, like, YouTube, Comic-Con, Holly Conrad movie, like, her audition tape is still online.
She's a person.
She's an individual who just, like, this is what she loves. This is her passion. And so she was going there to be in the Masquerade. And
right.
The Masquerade is this costume competition they have every year where thousands of people submit to be in this contest, and they pick, like, 50 out of all the people who submit their ideas. And then they prepare for, like, a year to be in this competition.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And then they kind of walk out.
Yeah, and they come out on stage, and they perform a little skit, and there's people who vote who are costume designers in Hollywood, and she's incredible. And so we got her video. I watched it. I sent it to Stan and Joss and Thomas and Harry, and I said I think she should be the first person we pick because I think she really represents what the film's about. And they saw it, and we were all blown away by her. And I called her up, and I said, we'd love to have you in the film. And she freaked out and was so super excited.
Screaming.
Yeah, and she's like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. It's like you won. It's like, I just won the lottery.
And then there are these two aspiring artists.
Amazing talents, both these guys. Eric Hansen, he's in the Air Force, still is in the Air Force. He's now stationed in Germany. And then Skip Harvey, who's based in Columbia, Missouri. And, you know, there are these two guys who basically have been drawing their whole lives. They've never, like, taken the chance to kind of go out and show anyone their work. And, you know, when they read the casting notice, they were like, you know what, this is my chance to actually do this. I'm going to go for it. And so they sent in their work and they sent us their tapes. And I said, they're both great. We should take them both.
But it's interesting because I didn't realize the degree to which Comic-Con is almost like a job fair for people as well.
Me either. I mean, I had no idea. And that's why I really wanted that story to be focused on. Because here's Holly, who's going there with her costumes to kind of show off her talents. Here's Skip and Eric, who are going there to kind of show their portfolios and lay themselves before the gods of Marvel and DC.
And there are people who are there to review those portfolios.
Amazing. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what Skip says. He goes, this is like, you know, a job fair for geeks. And I'd never known that side of Comic-Con.
Coming up after a short break, more with Morgan Spurlock. You can see Holly the Costume Designer's audition tape on our website, where you can also comment about today's show. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com.
Hi, this is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. Thanks so much for listening. Our show costs money to make, and we're dependent on listeners like you to make it. KCRW is a nonprofit, listener-supported public radio station. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Comic-Con, which started in 1970 as a gathering of comic book fans in San Diego, has ballooned into a massive annual marketing event with presentations about all kinds of films and television shows that may have nothing to do with the con's original mission. But Morgan Spurlock's new documentary, Comic-Con Episode 4, A Fan's Hope, follows a handful of the true comic book faithful who head to the event with a sense of mission. One of Spurlock's subjects is a member of the military who yearns to become a comic book illustrator. He's bringing his portfolio with the hope of getting good reviews from real comic book artists and the dream of getting a job.
It seems like I'm the oddball in a world of very normal people. But when I dream about like going to a place like Comic-Con, it's got to be like Nirvana. It's got to be the closest thing there is to heaven because other people there are just as much of a nerd as I am.
Among the producers of Spurlock's Comic-Con movie are comic book legend Stan Lee, Joss Whedon, creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Harry Knowles of Ain't It Cool News, and Thomas Tull, whose Legendary Pictures produces the Dark Knight movies. I asked Spurlock how involved these producers were in making the film.
You know, they gave their input as to what they thought were the most important things for us to cover. Like when we get the books, you get your book for Comic-Con and it's filled with like 5 days of insanity
stuff, yeah.
of stuff. And so then I would go back and, you know, I would tell them, here's how we're going to shoot the film. Here's what I think we're going to cover. Here are the most important stories with our characters and supporting characters. Here are the people we're reaching out to for interviews. And they would write back and say, well, we think this is great. We think this is great. Have you looked at this panel or these types of things? I mean, way back when we first started talking, I think it was Joss was one of the first people that talked about the portfolio reviews and said, you've got to look at that. Like they're all day long, there were people looking at portfolios up on the third floor. And I was like, I didn't even know this was happening. Somebody else said, oh, and you got to have the masquerade. And again, it was another one of those things.
Who knew
there was this giant costume competition happening at Comic-Con? And that's one of the things I love that Guillermo del Toro says in the film. He goes, Comic-Con is like a Russian doll, that there's so many other Comic-Cons
inside of
Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm. The fans just seem like they are people who truly want to live in a world where there are heroes.
Yeah. Which I think we all would love to live in a world where there are heroes.
Yes.
You know, like you want to live in a place where like somebody's going to be there to help. I just think, you know, some of us would love it for somebody to fly in a cape and take care of it, which how awesome would that be?
I mean, it feels so overwhelming. I wonder how many – did you have tons of different crews?
This was the biggest crew I've ever worked with in my life. We had 150 people working on the crew. Every character that we followed had a crew following them. Then we had support cameras with that crew so that at any time the 10 people we were following – you know, there could be a second camera. So 10 cameras could become 20 very easily. Then we had another five to seven that were bouncing around just the con itself, you know, shooting a panel, shooting an interview. And then we had the two psychs that were shooting consistently throughout Comic-Con. So we're interviewing fans on one and interviewing kind of celebrities, writers, directors on the other one.
Wow.
So at any time, we were shooting anywhere from 10 to 27 cameras.
So given the chaos of Comic-Con and the people.
Crazy. 150,000 people. And you feel it when you're shooting there with a camera crew as you're trying to get through.
I mean, were you getting smacked around?
Sort of. I usually get smacked around a lot when we shoot. It's not out of the ordinary. You know, it's usually pretty normal. But it's difficult to shoot around a crowd like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a big thing now. I mean, mm-hmm. It's become sort of controversial. What is Comic-Con? And is Comic-Con jumping the shark? What do you think of that?
Well, there's people who say, they're like, well, it's been taken over by Hollywood. You know, Hollywood's taken over Comic-Con. I said, no, it hasn't taken over Comic-Con. Hollywood's taken over your coverage of Comic-Con. Hollywood's taken over your news stories because you want to tell a news story. And the news story is an Angelina Jolie came to Comic-Con today because that's the story. That's the news. There's 6,000 people in Hall H watching movies get, you know, previewed and released. There's 144,000 people that aren't anywhere near Hall H during Comic-Con.
And don't want to go near Hall H.
And you know, there's some that will go or some that will get in line for other things. But the majority of people aren't there for the movie launches. There's still plenty of other people there that are participating in everything else that is Comic-Con. So I think that it all comes down to what people talk about. And we live in a time where the news cycle is stars and celebrities. And that's movies.
So is this the first one that you were not on camera? I'm trying to remember.
I was not on camera in Freakonomics, although I did the voiceover for the piece of Freakonomics.
How is that? I mean, having done
it's
this.
Awesome. It's fantastic. It's great. I'm a big fan.
Yeah? I mean, of not being on camera?
Listen, I've got a face made for radio already, so it's perfect that I'm behind the camera.
Somehow you've made it work for a couple of movies. So I'm just wondering whether there's a part of, I mean, whether you, is it easier?
To be behind the camera? Well, it's, you can, especially on a film like this, I couldn't imagine like if I would have had to have been on camera and still try to deal with things. Because logistically, this movie was so massive. You know, there were so many people, so many moving parts, so many decisions that we had to make on the fly constantly. And, you know, it was myself, it was my producers, Jeremy Chilnick and Matthew Galkin, who we were literally on the ground every day dealing with the film. You know, for the three of us, there were a lot of things that we had to flip a switch on right then and there. And if I'd have been dealing with having to be on camera and direct, it would have been impossible.
Now, you have a distribution plan that is theatrical, VOD, day and date, right?
Yeah. Well, after Greatest Movie Ever Sold, you know, which I was very proud of that film, and we got so much press attention around that movie, when that movie opened, you know, the lesson that I learned is that, you know, with documentaries where you're getting so much press, you need to capitalize on that focus as quickly as you can, or people are just going to forget about it.
It goes away.
Yeah, it goes away. So Greatest Movie Ever Sold, you know, we got tons of press. Like the week the film opened, I was on Kimmel, I was on, you know, Conan, I was on Colbert, and then the movie opened on 18 screens all across the entire. So here we had this movie with all that attention that you could only see if you were in one of those one of those 18, and it wasn't even 18 markets, I think it was 10 markets with 18 screens. And so when we finished Comic-Con, we're getting that ready, I said, we have to release this movie differently. And the distributors that we're working with, Reckonhill and NECA, very much got that, you know, that we wanted to have a different distribution plan, and we talked about it. And so it's going to be a combination of a limited release in select cities. It's going to be coming out, you know, on April 6th in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, and also on April 6th, it's going to be day and date across the country. So on demand, wherever you are on your house that Friday, you'll be able to watch it on demand. You'll be able to download it from iTunes. By way of your TV on every cable service provider. It'll be on iTunes. If you have Xbox and download your movies on Xbox, if you're plugged in the internet, you'll be able to get it from there. You know, you name it. It's going to be fantastic.
So do you have any sense, any forecast on, like, we expect X amount?
I expect millions. I don't know.
But percentage-wise, let's say, from theatrical versus on demand?
Well, I mean, ultimately, we don't know, because part of what we're also combining with this is the ability for fans, people who want to have the movie come to their town, to basically request it. And so we will basically launch a Kickstarter campaign that will then raise, well, you'll be able to raise the money if you sell a certain number of tickets for your town, we'll bring the movie to your town.
Wow. It's like very interactive release, this one.
Well, this is a very interactive topic. Like, people love this world. Like, people who love comics, they love video games, you know, they love these genre films, they love, you know, this whole world. We wanted to make sure they had the ability to bring the film to their town, because as great as the movie is watching it by yourself, it's so much more fun.
Well, sure, you want to have a party.
Yeah, you want to have
people.
So you could have a party at your house, or, you know, you could arrange to have it at a theater. You know, it's to watch this. When we premiered the movie at the Toronto Film Festival, and it was also at Fantastic Fest in Austin, people came in costume. It was like the new Rocky
the
Horror
Rocky
Picture
Horror Show.
Yeah, it was like this fantastic geeky Rocky Horror Picture Show experience. And I was like, people need this in every town.
So do you know how many people you need? If we have a listener who's in Michigan,
yeah.
I think we're in the air in Michigan.
Yeah, it's like right now we're talking about, you know, depending on what theater it is, it's like a 500-seat theater. You sell 500 tickets, it'll come right in, or 1,000 tickets. We'll be there.
At a normalish ticket price?
Yeah, but we'll also combine it with like premiums where we're going to give people the chance to buy a movie ticket and the DVD now in advance. They'll be able to do, you know, buy a movie and a limited edition DVD that'll come with action figures. You know, we're doing a lot of really cool things that haven't normally been done with a release.
Day and date, this kind of, and VOD and all the bells and whistles. Mm-hmm. Is that the way to go for documentaries, you think?
I think it's, I think it's the way to go with documentaries, especially if you have a doc that's coming out in theaters and is going to get some press because you want people to see it. You know, I grew up in Beckley, West Virginia. No one in my – I have yet to have a movie play in my hometown.
Oh,
This is my fifth movie, and I have yet to have one movie play in my hometown. Like, they played an hour away in the Capitol in Charleston, but never in my own city. So for me, yeah, absolutely. Think of me growing up as a kid, the movies that I couldn't see that I wanted to. You know, this is a chance to really reach all those people at once when they are like, oh, my God, I'd like to see that film. Well, now you can. And you can bring your friends over. You can put on costumes. You can have your own little party that night. It'd be amazing.
Morgan Spurlock is a filmmaker whose latest movie is Comic-Con Episode 4, A Fan's Hope. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters, and may the force be with you.